Welcome everyone to today's Fireside Chat. This is number 411 for CH Networks, our project here at the University of Ottawa. Today's date is September 24th, 2014. Our session will go from 1 to 2 p.m. today, and then our presenters have kindly offered to stay on the telephone line. So if those of you who are interested and available, please do stay on the line with us and you can continue the conversation. Our topic today is Mind the Gap, Developing Skills to Navigate Cultural Issues with Newcomers, Children, Youth, and Families. We have two presenters today. First is Dr. Zhang Vo, and he's a clinical assistant professor at the University of British Columbia. And then Dr. Maureen Mayhew, who is a clinical associate professor at the University of British Columbia. So when you folks start your presentation, you can introduce yourself a little bit further if you like. Going to slide number 4, so over to you, Zhang and Maureen.
Thank you, Dot. It's Maureen Mayhew who's going to speak first, and welcome to Mind the Gap. Just to give you a bit more introduction, I've been in practice, in family practice and international work for the last 25 years, and in the last 10 years I've worked quite a bit with refugees and immigrants and currently work at the BC Centre for Disease Control and Tuberculosis. So kind of a broad skill set and exposure. So I wanted to start off by asking how people would describe yourselves, and so that we get a good idea of who's in the room. And I know that Dot's already done this to some extent, but it would be great if you could.
We're going to do this. So this is slide number 5. So I'm going to open up the pod, and this is for people who are on Adobe Connect. They could go ahead and put a check mark in whichever. How do you describe yourself? So briefly, for people joining in by telephone only, we've got so far, I know we have several pediatricians joining in, and a couple nurses, and some other healthcare workers. They describe themselves as other healthcare workers, a policymaker, and 4 people in the other category. Thanks very much.
We're going to slide number 6.
Okay.
So I'll just go through the learning objectives that we've come up with. The first is to discuss why culturally appropriate care matters. It really does, and we'll discuss that a little bit. Then the second is to explain how culture influences health care and its outcomes. And then how might you address this in your practice, and that's a key part of this. The third is to describe the role of acculturation and identity development on health, and Dr. Vo will discuss that. And then we'll also go into some culturally appropriate skills in taking patient history, and we hope that you will have those skills either at the end of the lecture, but also throughout using the website Caring for Kids New to Canada. Slide number 7. I tend to forget my slide numbers, I'm sorry about that, but
I'll remind you.
My best. So why culturally appropriate care matters? Well, it essentially, one of the main things is it improves patient safety. And what do we mean by that? Well, I mean that people are more happy and comfortable in expressing what they feel about disease, about their symptoms, about their situation. So there's a lot, it's a really about trust and sharing of information. And the second thing that leads to is patient satisfaction, because you can imagine that the patient would then receive better care and feel as though they're better understood. And I didn't put in there, but there's also provider satisfaction, because you might feel if you practice culturally appropriate care that you provide better care that's more targeted towards what the patient cares about and what they believe they have. And then, of course, the last one is, because of all of that, it leads to better health outcomes for a variety of reasons. Some of that's adherence to treatment, some of that's that they believe what you say. There's a whole variety of things regarding that. Slide number 8. So this is about dealing with what is, and it's two stories about when I was in Afghanistan. I was in Afghanistan for a period of 11 years beginning in 2000, and the very first time I went there, I was involved in a maternal child health clinic setup for Médecins Sans Frontières, MSF. And our focus was really on women and children. But because of the cultural issues that we were faced with, and the fact that men brought women to the clinic and the decision-making in the home involved the men, we actually had to deal with the men, and we were not allowed to build the maternal child health care unit until we agreed to build one for the men as well. And so that was just an example of how one's program may change because of some cultural issues. The second story is about a person who is about my guard, a very religious fellow. He had three wives, two of whom were still living, one had died in childbirth. And one of the focuses of our maternal program was contraception and birth spacing. And so he came to me one day and said, hey, you know, I'd really like to know more about birth spacing. My wife, number two, is getting weak. And so we discussed this and came up with him walking away with the rhythm method. And I knew he was going to have challenges with this, but he had to figure it out himself. So he went home, discussed it with his wives. Meanwhile, I'd never met his wives, and came back 2 days later saying, I don't think that will work. And then ultimately we discussed some more, and ultimately he decided on Depo-Provera injection. And that's when I met his wives. I was invited for tea, and then I was able to discuss and the various methods with the wives, come up with a suitable way of doing it, and then we, in the end, did the injection. And 9 months later, they came to, or actually 1 year later, I was back in the country, and I saw them again, and he said he was kind of upset because he was afraid that I had sterilized his wife because she hadn't had her period, so we had to discuss that too. So that just illustrates an element of trust and an element of access, and my way of accessing the women was through the man. So the next slide, number 9, deals with terminology, and we have inpatient-centered care, which I think we all know what that is, and it's basically providing care that's centered around the patient and what the patient, what means a lot to the patient. So we have cultural competence, which is the skills that you learn that enable you to provide more effective care, so it's your learning. Then we also have cultural safety, which is the result of the effective learning on your part. So that's how the patient benefits from what you have learned and the cultural competence that you provide. And then the third one is cultural humility, which involves your ongoing commitment to explore and your own bias and figure out how that works in the relationships with patients. Slide 10 goes into some definitions of culture from Webster's Dictionary. One definition is the beliefs, customs, arts, etc. of a particular society, group, place, or time. So you can see that the various groups are quite different, and therefore cultures are not uniform. And then the second is a way of thinking, behaving, or working that exists in a place or organization, and that introduces the idea of the culture of, say, healthcare, something that most of us are familiar with, but patients aren't necessarily. And one of the things that's interesting about culture is that it's constantly evolving, and that often there's periods of stability, and then there's interspersed rapid change periods that are very significant in reaching the next level that the culture arrives at. Slide number 11 is about the visible and invisible elements of culture. And so this is the iceberg analogy, and we have the visible aspects of culture such as dress and festivals and music and food and all those things that we think of when we think of other cultures. But the invisible part of the bottom side of the iceberg, which is always hidden, and those are really, really important if you're going to be dealing in cross-cultural medical care or any other care, if you're truly trying to understand where the other people are coming from. And it's about the communication style and the values and how we prioritize things in life, whether we compete or cooperate, ethics, all those kinds of things. Slide number 12 is about some of the aspects of culture that influence health care. And so I've put them into a little diagram here. If you look at the top, there's a view of health and illness. And so people from different cultures often view health and illness quite differently. And I'll take an example of the healthy person in Vancouver is usually slim, athletic, and well-educated. And if I take by contrast, the healthy woman in Afghanistan, the word that they use is fat, and fat and strong are analogous in the language that I was used to. Another example is in the experience of pain. There are some cultures who tend to minimize pain, and the cultures that come to mind are some of the Eastern Asian cultures. And then there are other cultures that tend to maximize pain. And the refugee groups that I've been working with, often the Iranians and the Iraqis are more likely than, say, the Bhutanese to show their pain. And we need to be careful about how we address that, because we may over or underestimate the pain experience. There's also complying with treatment. If they believe in the treatment that you're providing, they are more likely to comply with it. Another aspect is in the interaction with the healthcare worker. Often I've seen in notes people write, "No eye contact." Well, that may not be all that indicative of depression in an East Asian patient who's female and meeting a male healthcare worker. And then stigmatization of disease. We all know a whole lot of diseases that are stigmatizing, and the stigmas vary quite a bit in different cultural milieus. So slide 13, I'm just going to speak a little bit about a real case. This is a 12-year-old Sudanese girl who is accompanied by her parents, and she comes to you on her first visit, and you find that she's quiet and withdrawn. And in speaking with her, you find that she interprets for her parents, who both suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. They trust no one but her to interpret for them, and they feel that the clinic interpreter comes from a group that has persecuted them in Sudan. And the mother begins with complaints of body pain, poor sleep, constant worry about herself, and constant worry about her 12-year-old daughter. The dad suffers in silence, and he has no job, and you know this from previous notes. And the family lives in a one-bedroom basement suite that is poorly maintained. So this is one of these polling questions, and if you go to slide 14, I ask you, at this visit, what would you address? And so there are various options there.
Dot speaking, I'm going to set this up one moment while I open up the pod. Here we go. So make a choice. What would you address at the visit? So maybe people are thinking about this one. I should have put one at the bottom that said, "I don't know." Okay, so some responses, people plucking up their courage and taking a guess. So four people are saying number one.
Yeah. Okay.
And two people are saying number six, which is 1, 2, and 3.
Three people, number six, and five, one.
5, 1, 2, that number one, which is address the use of a child as interpreter.
And then one person, number two.
Yeah, assess mother's ability to care for the child. Nobody's choosing 3, 4, 5, which would be assess adaptation issues in the child, assess housing, assess father's PTSD.
Well, I think we'll close
it
just in the interest of time.
Okay.
But you know, there's some diversity in the answers that came, and it's not necessarily a really easy thing to address. I would address number 1, 2, and 3 because you don't need to necessarily address the mother's ability to care for the child in great detail, but you might want to get a sense of that. I would also address the child as interpreter like many other people, and then also I would address the issues of adaptation in the child and the effect of interpretation on that adaptation process. Dung, did you have a different...
Well, I agree with everything Maureen said, but the only other thing I'm wondering is the father's PTSD, and I'm wondering how severe is it, and is he suicidal, or are there any acute safety concerns? That would be a question on my mind.
Yep. And in many situations, depending on where you sit and what your job is, you're going to answer this somewhat differently, of course. So we'll go on to the next slide, number 15. So migration is change, and no matter how you cut it, it is about change. And so if we look at the settlement literature, they have come up with four stages of change during settlement, and they have a very linear process of happiness and fascination as stage one, then stage two is disappointment, confusion, frustration, at oftentimes the losses that have been experienced, a loss of social status, a loss of finances, a loss of a house, friends, etc. Then there's often a gradual adaptation, adjustment, or recovery, and finally acceptance and adjustment. But in reality, this is a very fluid process, and often you can jump from one to the next, and you don't necessarily even start at the beginning. You may start with disappointment or confusion, or you might start to adjust and be kind of neutral, but adjust, and then you flip back. So it's very non-linear in how it evolves. But it's useful to figure out during your assessment where the child or the family is in this process and what they might expect of the other stages as well. So the next slide, 16, is a very quick look at what migrants adapt to, and it took me about 2 minutes one time to make this slide, and so it's an incomplete list of things, and it pertains to the iceberg that you've seen previously. So we have things like child protection and discipline. Discipline in other countries often allows certain things that we're not allowed to do. Hitting can be an okay thing in some countries, whereas when we come here, people are not allowed to hit their children, and there's consequence that's rather large for that. Housing, they adapt to a completely different housing situation. Oftentimes they may have come from a place where they had a really nice house, and they live in, like this family does, in a one-bedroom basement, poorly managed house of some sort. Sense of security may change as well, and racism also can be part of that. And if we keep on going through, you can see school, climate, the gender roles are obviously different, say, from the Afghan example. Social norms, sometimes the 12-year-old in Sudan is not allowed to go out with boys, whereas here maybe there would be a little bit more latitude. We have language, which is an obvious one, loss, as I've discussed before, and often people can't get the same employment as they could where they were before. And then there's a few more that I just added, but I won't go in great detail So moving on to slide number 18, we go into what is LEARN. Well, LEARN is a tool to enable provision, a provider to provide culturally competent care, and it's a very simple model. It's about listening with sympathy and understanding, explaining how you view the problem and the and some of the issues the person faces, and then acknowledging and discussing differences and similarities, recommending treatment, and then there's a negotiation piece. And you might argue that we should all do that all the time with all patients that we might see. Not sure why there are two. No, go back. So I'm not sure why there are two 18s, but this is now slide real 18, I think. And so going a little bit more into the listen part of things, you can look at the patient perception of the health condition, like with the 12-year-old, what's her perception. You think of what the agenda is of her and of her parents. You might look at post and pre-migration issues and the stress and trauma that may have occurred throughout the migration journey. Of course, you want to look at what stage of adaptation they are in. With the 12-year-old, maybe the fact she's interpreting is hindering her adaptation and keeping her keeping her stuck, and so she's not moving forward. There may be family conflict because there's a difference usually in the way that children adapt and the rapidity with which they adapt, and that which the rest of the parents adapt to. And then we look at discrimination and risky behaviors like we would always with adolescents, as well as basic needs. Are they being met? And then explaining your perceptions of the problems. One of the key pieces of this is to know your own biases really, really well, because you're going to have to be looking at them while you listen to the story and while you reframe what you have heard from the patient. And then acknowledging and the strengths and resilience and the ability that a patient may have demonstrated in adapting and surviving the experiences that they have gone through. So going to slide 20, then we've got the acknowledging piece. So in the 12-year-old's situation, if we're going to discuss the interpreter issue, you may want to say that that you understand that it's really important that for them that they trust their interpreter, but then you might want to point out some of the issues that you see that the 12-year-old will face in providing the interpreter services that are better provided by someone who's older and perhaps not the child of the parents. And you may decide that you're going to stand firm on that. You may decide that there's some wiggle room in this particular situation. I would stand firm on that. And then you need to figure out how to move forward, so you negotiate an agreement with the parents and the child to try and meet the agenda, your agenda of not having the child interpret and their agenda of having a trusting interpreter or an interpreter that they trust. So now we'll move to slide 21. And this is just a quick thing about knowing your own biases. Always remember that an individual is a product of all the cultural environments that they exist in. So we often have a work environment, an education environment, a family environment, and an extended social environment. And all of those cultures come together and create the culture that's somewhat individual for the individual. And it's important, as I kind of alluded to before, to recognize that a healthcare system has a culture all its own, and that this culture is familiar to you, but very foreign often to a patient. And in fact, go to slide 22, people often come from a private healthcare system to a public system, and for many, the Canadian system makes absolutely no sense, and it's very, very complicated. Slide number 23 we have is directly from the CKNC, the Kids New to Canada website, explaining the use of an interpreter and what you can do prior, during, and after. And I won't go into any of that, just to show you that it exists. I will bring up three terms. There's translator, which usually pertains to written work, interpreters, which is usually oral interpretation, and then a cultural broker is often someone who provides interpreter services as well as helping you navigate through the culture in helping the patient. And then the last slide is slide number 24, just a few tips. Identify the support system. So, like for the Sudanese child, what kind of support system exists for that child in the family but also extended? What kind of language skills does that person have? What kind of health literacy do they have, and what level should you target for the mom and the parents as well as for the child? And then the stage of adaptation to Canada, where are they in that, and what might be the expectation for the near future going forward? And then the other thing to always think about is, are visual or spoken messages more useful than printed messages at this point in time? And so I think we're going to go directly into Dr. Vo's presentation. I'm off the thing. Oh, that's okay.
You had an animation.
I had an animation. And it was purely to say, remember that other people, that immigrants have often survived events that you can only begin to imagine. So, Dr. Vo.
Okay, thanks, Maureen, for really making the case of why culturally competent healthcare is so critical. I'm going to move into a framework of how we can understand cultural issues in children and youth, and then present some practical examples of how we can apply this. So I want to talk a little bit about acculturation and ethnic identity development. And these are frameworks which we can help us to understand moving beyond racial and ethnic group membership. In other words, it's not just an Afghani woman, for example, but what does that mean to her? So a case I'd like to share is a 14-year-old girl who I cared for. She is a 1.5 generation immigrant, and that means that her parents were born in China and she was born in Canada fairly young, I think around school age. Working class family, dad works at a restaurant, mom works at a travel agency, and she was admitted to our hospital for severe malnutrition secondary to anorexia nervosa, so an eating disorder. Moving to slide number 27. So on the social history with the girl, she told us a lot about conflicts at home. She said things like, I hate Chinese food, I wish I wasn't Chinese, I can't stand my mom, we just fight all the time. And the mom admitted a lot of difficulty raising her kid as well. She says, I don't know how to raise a Canadian child. Things were different back home, and kids here are just are different, and we don't know how to raise children here. So she was really struggling. So moving on to slide number 28, I want to ask you guys, what are some initial thoughts that come to your mind in how you might approach the cultural issues here? Dot, do you want to open up the...
There you go. There's the poll. So folks, give a vote for one of these things. Would you recommend a parenting class? Say to the mom, your daughter is in Canada now. She's not Chinese anymore. Say to the teen, you're lucky to have a mom who cooks great Chinese food. Or D, explore acculturation and ethnic identity, which has 11 votes.
Okay, so that was pretty unanimous. So let's move into how we might explore those acculturation and ethnic identity issues. And what kind of tools and frameworks can we use in order to do that? So when we look at racial and ethnic categories, they're really homogenous groups, like she's Chinese-Canadian, or he's Afghani. But I think that can be useful up to a point, but it really has a risk of stereotyping, of making us think, oh, well, if I just know about Vietnamese culture or Iraqi culture, then I know how to treat this youth. But the truth is every youth is a unique individual. And as Maureen said, we want to practice patient-centered care. We really want to see people as individuals and understand who they are rather than just stereotyping them by their ethnic group. But also, as Maureen really made the case, that culture and race and ethnicity play very important roles in health and how we understand health and how we behave. So the question is, how can we understand the role of culture in a way that respects people as individuals but also acknowledges the complex cultural context? So one model I want to present to you is called racial and ethnic identity development. And Erik Erikson, one of the famous developmental psychologists of the 20th century, described adolescence as their main identity, their main developmental task is figuring out their identity. In other words, who am I? Where do I fit in? And racial ethnic identity development theory takes that one step further, and it says for young people who are racial or ethnic minorities or immigrants, how do I relate to my own race and ethnicity? In other words, what does being a Chinese Canadian mean to me? Or what does being from Iraq mean to me? And how do I feel like I belong to that group? What's my sense of commitment and belonging to that particular community? And Gene Finney proposed a three-step model. There's several different models of this, but they have a lot in common. So I'm presenting Finney's model as one of the ones that's cited most in the literature. So the three stages, it starts with unexamined. And that basically means that they haven't really thought too much about their identity issues. They often have a preference for the dominant culture, and they're not really too interested in their ethnic identity. We see this sometimes in early adolescence, but this can also happen in adults as well. So, for example, I'm not Chinese, I'm just a person, I don't really think about being Chinese. Second stage is an identity search. So at this point, people are trying to figure out who they are. Who am I? How do I fit in? Sometimes this is triggered by a significant experience that forces that awareness. So in my case, I'm a Vietnamese American. I grew up in the United States, but my parents are from Vietnam. And the trigger for me was my first trip to Vietnam as a teenager, and seeing where my parents came from, I really started to understand them better, and it started to make me reflect on how I was brought up, and it hadn't been something that I had thought about much of my childhood. During the identity search phase, people may become very proud of their culture, they may show ethnic pride, they may also reject the dominant culture during this time. The third stage is called achieved identity. And at this point, people have come to a deeper understanding and appreciation of their own identity. They're very confident in who they are. They accept and internalize that identity. And how they express this varies person to person and based on their community. Sometimes they may also be quite connected with the dominant culture as well. There is quite a bit of literature on ethnic identity and how that affects health. Racial and ethnic identity has been strongly linked to better self-esteem and self-worth. It's also been associated with improvements in a variety of mental health symptoms. And in youth, stronger ethnic identity has been associated with decreased substance use as well as decreased risk of youth violence. So it has a big effect on health. Thank you. Slide number 33 is about acculturation. So acculturation is another model that's related to ethnic identity development. And acculturation is defined as the process of change that results from prolonged contact from a new culture. So when immigrants or newcomer youth arrive in a new country, they go through a process of change, and that's described as acculturation. Traditionally, acculturation has been described as linear, which means you're less acculturated when you start, you're more acculturated over time. And it also assumes that involvement with the dominant culture and the culture of origin are mutually exclusive, and that the end point of acculturation is assimilation. That means you have become Canadian and you're no longer Japanese or Iraqi. So that's been the traditional model for a long time. And proxies of acculturation in the research have included immigration status, so were you born in the other country or were your parents born in the other country? Are you a first or second generation immigrant? What language do you speak? And what communities do you prefer to hang out with? Slide number 34. More recently, Barry and many other colleagues have developed a more complex model of acculturation, which I think describes what's happening better. And they basically look at two different dimensions. So the first dimension is issue number one on the slide, and that's, do I consider it valuable to maintain my culture of origin, my identity, and characteristics of where I came from or where my family came from? And either yes or no, and that lies along a continuum. And then the second question is, do I consider it value to maintain relationship with a larger dominant society? So getting outside of my own ethnic community, my own cultural community, and becoming integrated with a larger dominant community. And again, that is on a continuum from yes to no. And so you can see that depending on where you are on those two dimensions, it can lead to four different acculturation styles: integration, assimilation, separation, also called segregation, and marginalization. So moving to slide 35, describes a little bit more about these acculturation strategies. So assimilation, that is the strategy or the style where you would reject your culture of origin and your primary interest is participating in the new culture. So that's really the traditional model of acculturation. Integration means that I would retain my original culture, but I would also be accepting and interested in participating in the dominant culture. The separation style is when I would reject my original culture, but I'm also not connected with the dominant culture. I reject the new culture, but I maintain the original culture. So I would only hang out with people from my group. And marginalization is where I would reject both cultures or be separated from both cultures. So I want to share with you just a little bit about the research, slide number 36, how acculturation affects health. So in adults, the literature suggests that adults who have an integrated acculturation style where they are connected with both the dominant culture as well as their culture of origin, they tend to have lower levels of stress and higher levels of functioning. The literature in youth is less robust, but what the literature suggests so far is that youth who have an integrated acculturation style tend to have fewer risk behaviors, the health risk behaviors that we worry about with adolescents, such as substance use, sex risk behaviors, and violence. They tend to have more positive attitudes towards healthcare workers, and overall, they appear to have better psychological and functional outcomes. So even though the literature is still developing, it seems to suggest that an integrated acculturation style is a healthier acculturation strategy. Moving to slide number 37, there's this concept of an acculturation gap where when young people acculturate differently from their parents, that can cause family conflicts. It's associated with youth violence, and it's associated with depression and anxiety among children. So an example of that would be a young person who came over when they were 5 years old. They speak English. Most of their friends are diverse or Caucasian. Their parents may not speak English, and their parents are more in the separated acculturation strategy. Sometimes even the parents and the kids don't even speak the same primary language with each other, which can be really difficult. So that's something we should all be alert for. Moving on to slide number 38, the bottom line for clinicians, not expecting clinicians to be experts in acculturation and identity development, but it's important for us to know that there's a diversity of identity and acculturation styles. And also that identity and acculturation development is fluid, it's dynamic. I presented a very simplistic model that goes from one direction to another, but in reality, it often goes in multiple directions, and it can go through many different cycles. But the bottom line is that acculturation and identity have huge effects on health and behaviors, especially among children and adolescents. So we need to be alert for this and learn how to think about and explore these issues. So moving back to slide number 39, How would you describe this girl, the 14-year-old girl who I admitted for an eating disorder? What's her acculturation style?
Okay, so I've opened up the pod here. So the choices are A, assimilation, B, integration, C, no votes for that, votes for the first one on A, on assimilation, no votes for separation or segregation, D, two votes, marginalization, where both the original culture and the new culture are rejected.
Okay. So most people voted for assimilation, and I would agree with that. She said, I'm not Chinese. I didn't include some of the other information, but she hangs out with mostly white people, and she's a bit ashamed of being Chinese. So that was her strategy. So that was one of our interventions, is to try to get some culturally competent family counseling for her. So we're going to move on to how can we address these issues when we take our history. So slide number 40. And the take-home point from this is that having a culturally appropriate approach as strategy is more important than developing a checklist. So I'm going to give you some examples of questions, but I'm not suggesting that you go through these questions in a checklist style trying to get all the questions. It's more important to have a general approach. Slide number 41. As Maureen says, it's important to assess immigration history and trauma. So some example questions. What is your country of origin? What group do you identify with? Who do you like to hang out with? What language do you prefer? And it's important to note that it could be different for the child and for the parents. What and when and why did you come to Canada? What's been tough? And what's helped you to adjust and cope? So that's getting at strengths and protective factors and resilience factors. So we're not just interested in what their challenges are, but we're also interested in how they are able to cope with and bounce back from those challenges. Slide number 42. So we want to ask and assess some questions about the young person's identity development and acculturation. So do the parents and the children in the family speak the same primary language? And that can get at any acculturation gaps. When you're meeting with a teenager alone, you can ask them, how do you get along with your parents? Are you close with them? What do you argue about? Do you feel more comfortable being with people from your family's background? So do you feel more comfortable hanging out with other Chinese Canadians or with mainstream Canadian society, or both, or neither? And that's kind of a way of operationalizing that multidimensional acculturation model from Barry. And sometimes I just ask very open-ended question. What does being from this group mean to you? So what does being Iraqi mean to you? Do you identify with that? Moving on to slide number 43. These are some examples of questions that you can ask to get at the cultural dimensions of health and health beliefs. As Maureen described, culture has a huge effect on how we understand health and healthcare. So you can ask questions like, what do you think has caused this issue? What do you call it? How do you understand it? And you might ask this question both to the parent as well as the children, and they may give you different answers. What do you fear most about this problem? And one of the things I'm particularly interested in is, especially when we're talking about stigmatized issues, so for example, mental health concerns or something like HIV, which are highly stigmatized, it could be that the family is, the thing they're most afraid of is their community finding out and isolating them for this. So you can get a sense of what is their biggest concern about this issue. And then, are there any healing practices or medicines that are traditional for your family that you think might help? So this can help with that negotiating process. It doesn't have to be an either-or process, but it can be a both-and in terms of using traditional practices as well as Western medicine practices. I think it's important to screen all teenagers equally. I've had several providers tell me, you know, in this clinic we see mostly Asian kids, and they're good kids, and they don't do drugs, and they're not having sex, so we don't bother asking them about that. And that's a huge assumption. It's a huge stereotype, and actually teens perceive that as discriminatory. So I think it's important to meet with all teens alone, meet with them confidentially, and do a confidential, developmentally appropriate psychosocial assessment, like a HEDS or SHADES. Slide number 45. it's important to know that teens have different perceptions about working with interpreters. And some of the research I did with Asian American youth in Philadelphia, what we learned was that teenagers who spoke English better, they were actually ashamed to be asked to interpret because they felt incompetent in language. And they also felt that they had the right to their own private information. Teenagers who had arrived earlier, so the first generation, they felt that their parents had the right to know everything about their health. Some of the teens also told us they would intentionally mistranslate in order to protect themselves or to protect their families from difficult information. So there's a real danger in asking teenagers to translate. So the take-home points for our talk, immigrants are diverse, their cultures are evolving. Culturally competent care makes a huge difference in outcomes and satisfaction. It's very important to be mindful of our own cultural biases as healthcare providers, as well as human beings, when we're negotiating these options. And we should be alert to identity and acculturation issues and learn how to explore some of these things. Slide number 47. I want to end this talk with just sharing a few resources from Kids New to Canada. This is an online textbook. It's updated from a print textbook from, I think, about 10 years ago or so. It's evidence-informed, it's peer-reviewed, and best of all, it's free. It's sponsored by Immigration Canada and the Canadian Pediatric Society. Slide number 48 shows a screenshot. This is the home page, and you can see some of the general topic areas up at the top: assessment and screening, medical conditions, mental health and development, health promotion, culture and health, navigating the health system, and education and advocacy. So if you wanted to learn more about the topic that Maureen and I presented today, you would click on culture and health. So clicking on that, going to slide number 49 is a screenshot of that, and there's chapters on adaptation and acculturation, cultural competence. There's lots of tools and resources as well. Moving to slide number 50, that's what the cultural competence page looks like. So it really hits bullet points and take-home points at the top, and then gives information, and then more references and resources. So it's meant to be very practical and hands-on, not too academic, but it is evidence-informed and peer-reviewed. Slide number 51. So some tools, especially on the right-hand side, you see taking a history. And so slide number 52 is a one-page document on taking a history. So describe some of the questions that we covered at the presentation. Slide number 53, there's still more to come. This is a work in progress. We're developing medical assessment checklists. There's two chapters on adolescent health that will be published in the next few months. We have the webinar series, which today is the first, and we've just recently learned that Caring for Kids New to Canada is going to be an ongoing project of the CPS, so we're going to have ongoing support and educational work around this. So slide number 54, we're at the end of our formal presentation. We have a few minutes for questions. I'm going to turn it over to Doc to facilitate the question session.
Excellent. Thank you. What a tremendous presentation. I find it at once challenging and very encouraging, and what great news to have the project on Caring for Kids New to Canada. This is great. I'm going to remind all the participants, could you please post your comments and questions? What questions do you have? What challenges are you dealing with? What do you wish you knew more about? Post your comments and questions there. And we're going to get to those right now. I'm going to start with one that came in by email, and with thanks to Angie. So she's asking, as a non-clinical professional, I'm a youth facilitator, how do I get this information without opening a kettle of fish I'm not qualified to deal with?
So I'll take a stab at this. This is Zoom. That's a really challenging question, and the truth is trained clinical professionals also ask these questions, and we are often anxious in opening up kettle of fish that we feel either unqualified or overwhelmed to deal with. So you're not alone in asking that question. I think the most important thing when you're working with youth is to know your resources, to know your local community resources, your local health resources, and your local mental health resources, so that way if you do open up a kettle of fish, you can connect kids to the resources they need. And as a youth worker, you're actually uniquely positioned to do that because you often will have the closest relationship with these young people, and that connectedness is actually one of the most important protective factors that they can have. Maureen, anything to add?
No, I totally agree. I think the resources, the link to resources is the most important thing.
Wonderful. Angie, there's an answer for you, a very helpful one. Start with that. Let me know if you have a follow-up question on that. And here's a thanks to the next person who's posted a question. It has to do with slide 15. So if you folks can jog back to slide 15 on the PowerPoint presentation. The question is, do refugees experience the same migration stages as outlined on slide number 15?
This is Maureen. You know, certainly there's elements that are true in refugees and immigrants, and there's a lot of the refugees that I have seen do go through a, wow, this is so easy, this is great, and then there's a lot of disappointment as they meet all the obstacles and the barriers that they inevitably do meet. And then there's a period of adjustment, but and as I said, it's not linear, and it can kind of yo-yo from happiness, then disappointment, then back to happiness, and so there's a lot of variability in how things present, and certainly there are people who never get to acceptance as well. But a lot of people over time with, you know, slow progress can still make it to adaptation and, not assimilation.
Integration.
Yeah.
Hard work to remember which term to use.
Well, you know, they're models from different literature bodies, and so the settlement literature has this very simplistic kind of framework, whereas some of the psychology literature is more complicated.
Excellent, thanks. There's another question. Is there a poverty tool that you would use or recommend to assess poverty? Slide 51.
Okay, I can afford to slide 51.
Yeah, it's going to take us just a few seconds there.
51.
Here you go. Okay, so the question again was, is there a poverty tool that you would use or recommend to assess poverty?
It's Maureen. I've never actually used a tool. I know that there's a recent book out about that kind of about developing those kinds of things, and I know that there's a family physician who's very keen on that. I know a couple of people in BC are working on that kind of thing, but I don't know of any particular tool that is currently well known and well used.
Yeah, this is Zoom. I can share a mnemonic that we sometimes use. It's not a validated or quantitative tool, but it's a way to help providers look at the social determinants of health, and it came out of the social pediatrics literature, and it's called It Helps. And I don't remember each one of it, but it's something like income, transportation, housing, employment, legal issues, primary care, something like that. So it's basically a mnemonic to get at what are the poverty and social determinants of health issues that can be affecting their health and help us to kind of look more broadly. And I can send that out to Dot. I can send that to Dot if I can find that article.
Actually, you know what? I would be very happy to get that out to people.
Yeah. The other thing that's useful on the website is there is a social determinants module, and I can't quite remember where it is, but if people look under the various headings, you will find a social determinants one, which will help with a lot of those kinds of things, and I don't know that there's something specific to looking at poverty in the absence of all the other things, but they're all related.
Okay, let us know if that's helpful. Oh, here we go. Gina's asking, how realistic is it in healthcare providers' practice? I think she is referring to be able to use these kinds of tools and take these kinds of actions?
This is Zoom. My opinion is that the traditional healthcare system and practice is not really set up to working with the complex issues that this population faces, so it really requires non-traditional models and non-traditional approaches to give you the time and connections and resources to meet the needs of these youth. And that looks different in every community.
Yeah, it's Maureen, and I mean, fee-for-service model of care as a form of compensation is extremely limiting in some ways, and it just doesn't lend itself to looking into a lot of the other components that are hugely important in this population. I know that in the refugee group that we were providing care for, we were all salary-based, and so we could provide care and a lot of in this way. And a lot of the people that we knew across Canada were also in predominantly non-fee-for-service models. But there are a lot of support groups that you can hook people up with, which can, if you have a simple tool that's kind of like an assessment tool that could be done in a waiting room or something like that, and then you could hook them up with resources. That's another way of going. And we do have on this website, we do have a source of resources, what are they called? Sort of complementary resources to support this cultural piece. And I think it's under the cultural and health heading, but I can't quite remember where it is. But it's definitely there, and it gives you a by-province breakdown of where you might look for the various bits of health support.
There you go. I'm hoping that's a helpful answer. Toby's posted a question and a comment as well. So she's saying she's agreeing with Marie. It's an excellent presentation, very good overview. And one of the things I'm struggling with in my newcomer clinic is PTS. Mixed with presentation of PTSD, developmental delays, and approach to diagnosis. So any suggestions for resources for Toby?
You know, this is a really tough issue. It's something that we face a lot in our social pediatrics project here in Vancouver. I'll just share what we're doing just very briefly. We're a multidisciplinary team working in an area of concentrated poverty with a lot of immigrants in the Vancouver inner city. And we have adolescent medicine. We also have a developmental behavioral pediatrics. We've got some excellent primary care nurse practitioners who do really wonderful developmental screening, and then we've made a lot of community partnerships with schools and with the developmental resources in the area. So I think it really takes a team approach and a multidisciplinary approach, and also getting to where the population is at rather than expecting them to come to the tertiary center, which doesn't work. But it's a very complex issue.
Indeed. So Toby, follow up with a comment or a question with that. There was another comment. She says, we're also developing and validating a screening tool for social determinants of health here in Ottawa, and it's based on CANS or CANS by John Lyons.
Yeah, we'd be really interested in learning about that.
Okay, and so she's put her email in there in the text chat, so a wonderful way for you to get in touch. If I keep looking at the text chat, I'm going to check my emails now and then as well. Elizabeth has posted a couple sources or a couple links. The first one was the link on Kids New to Canada. Can find lists of community resources serving newcomers across Canada. And a second posting, and here's some info on social determinants that Maureen has referred to. There it is. And I will get that out to all the participants as well in a follow-up email. It may not be to this afternoon, it might be tomorrow morning, but I will get that back, that out to you folks in a few days. Fantastic. Again, we are at 2:03, so we have a little bit of time now. And what I'm going to suggest, let's see if we can open up the teleconference lines. There are about 40 lines in use at the moment, so if folks on the lines can be patient and also be quiet in the background, that's going to help. You have a chance to make your comments, ask your questions directly via the teleconference. So I'm wondering if there is anybody who would pluck up their courage, unmute yourself there, introduce yourself and ask your question or just make your comment, even if you just want to say thanks very much, this has been helpful and this is why.
Hello, this is Katie Mitchell, Sarah Gesemi and Sue Chen from Vancouver Adolescent Medicine Trainees. And we had a question around acculturation gap, and once it's identified, tools or recommendations for how to manage that.
Okay, hi, this is Zoom. So I think that's another very challenging question, and we could have an hour discussion on it. I think the first thing, though, is just to recognize it out loud, because often parents don't or families don't really recognize it or they're afraid to talk about it. So just putting it out in the open. You know, your child is second generation. She grew up in Canada. You grew up in wherever you grew up in. Things are different, and it's really hard, and there can be a lot of challenges with that. So I think just giving permission and also in a way that takes away a little bit of the blame and the shame around it. So it's not because your child is a bad child and it's not because you are a bad parent, but it's because of this gap coming from different cultures and that process of change. So I think that gives people permission to talk about it a little bit more. And then the second thing is just kind of exploring it with the child and with the parent, maybe alone and then together, and putting on the table exactly where what are some examples of this coming up. So the example I gave was around Chinese food. And so, you know, kind of exploring is that related to the underlying issue or not, and how can we negotiate that? And I think really the best way, which is not always possible or feasible, but the best way is to get a family connected with a counselor, a family therapist who's got a lot of expertise in this area, who can really help the family kind of learn how to communicate and understand each other better. That's not always feasible, but I think that would be the best strategy when possible.
Thank you.
Great. Excellent question and wonderful response to help you there. All right. We have still about...
Hi, it's Nasreen Diga at Durham Region Health Department, and I just wanted to share with both the speakers that this was an excellent presentation and very informative, and I also really enjoyed the rich discussions thereafter.
Thank you. Is there a particular way you're going to use some of the information?
I would think so. I think especially questions around assessment of poverty, but I think we work with schools, and this is information that can be integrated when looking at schools and the populations that we serve.
Great, thanks.
Well, maybe we should open it up to Elizabeth at the CPS, if Elizabeth has anything to add about the resource.
Sure. I just wanted to say, first of all, thank you to Dr. Vo and Dr. Mayhew for doing this webinar. This is actually the first in a webinar series that we're doing on caring for kids new to Canada based on the material on the website. Dr. Vo and Dr. Mayhew were members of the editorial board of Caring for Kids New to Canada, which developed the site over a period of 3 years. So we thank them very, very much for those efforts and for this fantastic presentation. The next webinar, if I could give it a little plug, will be in October, October 22nd, and it'll be on medical assessment. And then we have ones coming up on child development, on advocacy, and on mental health. So please keep checking back with CH Networks for more. We sent out a couple of links to some resources on the site that were mentioned. But in addition to all of the documents that were developed, we have presentations up there. We have slides that you can download if you're doing education in your own community. We have a couple of video presentations and so on. So please, you know, have a look through the site, and we would really love to hear feedback. So there are some ways to send feedback to us. So if you see some content gaps, if you see ways you can use the information, we'd really love to hear from you.
And I would just add to that, please share this resource with your colleagues and coworkers and partners in the community, because we really want this resource to get out there. It's not just for doctors or nurses or health providers even, but anyone working with immigrant and newcomer children and youth, so school people, youth workers, community support workers. It's really got a broad applicability, so please share it. And those of you who are educators, please share it with your trainees and your students also.
That's a great point. We have print materials, too, that we can share with folks. We have bookmarks. We have flyers. The pediatric residents are actually having an advocacy day, so if any of you are at an academic center at a pediatric hospital, the residents will be holding a day in November and will be highlighting immigrant and refugee child health as well as the site, so you could find information there as well.
Fantastic. And I'm curious, how do you get the printed info?
People can just email me. So, Dot, if when you're sending out a follow-up email, just include my email address.
Yep, I will.
If you want to just email me, we'd be happy to get that info out.
Okay, that's great.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Opportunity for all of you folks joining in to be in on the ground floor there.
And also, if people are in newcomer serving agencies, and we have not already listed your agency on our community resources page, and you think you belong there, also let us know, and we will add you there.
Excellent. If you had one last thought you'd like to leave with our participants, what would that be?
The last thought I would share is we've given you a lot of specific tools and examples of questions to ask, but in my experience, it's not so important what you say, but it's more important the quality of your presence and how you say it, because that's really what's going to help build that trust and convey that compassion and empathy that we're trying to do. So the quality of your presence is more important than what you say.
And I think I would, I'd like to close by saying it's really important to remain open and non-judgmental. And that sort of leads to the exploring of your own biases and knowing them well, because those biases are things that we live with that we've normalized and that we're not necessarily even aware of. And they can be hugely influential in the interaction that you share with a patient and in what Dr. Vo was just saying. So to me, that's a huge thing, is to remain open.